mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today we'll hear part two of my interview with John Densmore, drummer in the legendary Doors. We continue to talk about his new book, The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists, and cover the likes of percussionists Ayrton Moreira, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Willie Nelson. We also talk about Jay-Z sampling the Doors' music, and John's relationship with Robbie Krieger. In the interview, you'll hear me quote John from his book where he states that a good song is the wedding between lyric and melody. When I press him for an example, he starts to sing the Doors song, Crystal Ship. Let's hear some of the studio version of his example, and then I'll be back with John for part two of your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Another flashing chance and bliss, another kiss.
In that chapter two with Van Morrison, you reference space as the necessary dark matter. Oh, I think that's a great description there. Poetry on your part, in fact, maybe. Can you elaborate on the necessary dark matter?
Yeah, well, I read Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, was saying that dark matter is more important than matter, and it's bigger. And out of the void or whatever came the word. In the Bible it says there first there was the word. Well, that's a sound and that's a vibration. And so I think the balance between silence and sound is extremely important, and most people don't think about the silence, but there's a lot of space in Doors music.
Yeah.
And if you see the conductor Gustavo Dudamel finish a big Beethoven symphony, he keeps his hands up in the air for a minute or two, and we don't applaud until he puts them down. And that silence is so delicious after the sound. It's kind of like a yin and yang thing. They complement each other.
Oh, I can't think of the 20th century composer, John Cage. I was about to say John Cale, right?
Yeah, I saw him perform. He was over the top, but great. I mean, he said the silences are as important as the sounds. And I think Mozart said something like that too. So there's something in there. There's a crossover here between classical music and rock and roll. I know that the dynamics of classical music, you know, like fortissimo and pianissimo and everything in between, fed my drumming. It makes it musical and more human.
So classical music, you know, rock and roll, of course, is a pop music, and then it's can be tied to the pop market and selling records. And so there is this relationship between pop music and commerce. After Jim Morrison's passing, you've been a loud voice for keeping the Doors music out of commercials, and in your chapter about Patti Smith, you write how she's an inspiration for that. How so?
Well, she, I think, feels that rock and roll can be kind of sacred if you really care about it. And so if you're advertising deodorant, you're kind of watering down the intention of the lyrics, rather. Pete Townsend said, I don't give a F if you fell in love with Shirley to my song. I'll do what I want with it. Yeah. Right. You know, but Jim was so angry about "Come on, Buick, light my fire" that we were even considering it. I haven't forgotten that. And he's my ancestor now, and so I'm going to respect that.
So I think it's in that chapter, too, where you're writing about when music loses its center, new movements come up to shore it up. I'm thinking the quote is, "Each new wave challenges the modus operandi." What is challenging us now, do you think?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, the hippies were on the shoulders of the beatniks.
Right.
And the punks are on the shoulders of the hippies, and the grunge is on the shoulders of the punks. And what's going on now? Hip hop is pretty interesting. Got a lot of great political overtones.
Yeah.
In fact, when that first came up, Jay-Z wanted to sample 5 to 1, and I was kind of, wait a minute, what is this hip hop? Bitches and hoes? What? I don't know. And then he sent me a letter saying, you know, we're fighting the power just like you. And then I got into the lyrics and went, wow, yes, go ahead and sample.
Oh, and do you recall what the song, what his composition's called?
It was on his Blue album where he's smoking a cigar on the cover.
Well, I'm going to have to dig that out because I didn't know that, man.
Yeah.
I want you to tell me about Airto Moreira and why you consider him to be the world's greatest living percussionist.
Well, at the end of the chapter on him, I say go to YouTube.com and look up, I don't know what the instructions are, some drum festival. This guy could take a tambourine and I don't know how, but just sound like a friggin' a rainforest or an orchestra. He would make sounds with his mouth. He'd just play I can't even imitate how he would play the percussion, but he's just really extremely gifted. He's not well known, but well, he was in a lot of great fusion groups. He played with Miles and Chick Corea. So I love tipping the hat to some of these relatively unknown, brilliant musicians.
Fellow seekers.
Yeah.
Right. Well, here's something I thought was really cool that you guys were doing in the 60s. You had, when the Doors were active, you had Jerry Lee Lewis open up for you one time. And I thought it was pretty amazing that, you know, the crowd was heckling him and he kind of just let it pass like water off a duck's back. That wouldn't be the reaction that I would have thought about him. You've sat in with players, you know, of all sorts of musicians over the course of your career. You never actually sat in with Jerry Lee, though.
No, it's funny. He came to the gig and his musicians didn't bring any instruments. So, okay, can we borrow your drum? Sure. And Robbie Krieger says to Jerry Lee, "Well, I got a lot of guitars. Which kind do you want?" And he says, "Oh, any old Rockaday Fender guitar." And he kind of got heckled a little bit. And he got on the piano, stood on top of it, and said, "For those who love me, God love you. And for those who didn't, have a heart attack." The killer speaks.
Absolutely. I think I think it's in that section you're referring to art as a sleight of hand. So how is that? How is art a sleight of hand?
Well, you read this book, didn't you, Manfred?
Well, I was given the book and I was like, well, I want to, you know.
Well, let's see. You can't fix a spare tire with a painting. We're not plumbers. We're not practical.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow music is so, or any art sometimes is so powerful that countries will have you put in jail for it.
Right.
Like what happened to the eventual president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel, who was a writer and so provocative they put him in jail. And then he listened to the Velvet Underground, Lou Reed's group, while in jail, and it inspired him. And when he got out and became the president, you know, like Nelson Mandela, he invited Lou to interview him. And that's when second time I met Lou. So, there's some kind of powerful magic in the arts.
So Joseph Campbell, writer and philosopher, very important seeker for you. If his philosophy can be summarized as follow your bliss, Have you done so?
Well, it's not just folly or bliss. It's, let's see, what's the quote? Everything in the world is sorrow. And, you know, you still kind of try and follow your bliss through that. And that's that'll feed you through the troubles, kind of like this damn pandemic. You know, we got to really be careful. I'm wearing a mask right now. Not true. But I do. Look,
there's no one else right around you in your office. So,
Right.
So you were on a panel with Joseph Campbell shortly before he died. Can you tell us about your exchange with him?
Yeah, well, I said, I brought notes because I'm sitting next to the smartest guy in the world. And he was saying how he went to a Grateful Dead concert. He'd never been to a concert. And he said, wow, this is the Grateful Dead are the perfect answer to the atomic bomb. That was provocative. Meaning he could feel the communal spirit of everybody together.
Yeah.
And kind of the Woodstockian love vibe. And that's where we got to go.
So Peggy Fury was your acting teacher, and reading about her reminded me that when I was in my late high school years, I read an article in the paper that said you were dancing, and in the article, it wasn't saying you were, it was like a Dancing with the Stars sort of thing, but you were seriously studying dancing. So were you studying dancing around the same time you were pursuing acting lessons?
Well, that's not, that's been confused. I was mainly drumming for a dance company.
I see.
And I was on the downside of this giant Doors Peak. And, you know, it's steep. A lot of people get messed up on drugs and alcohol. And I stumbled into this acting class, and I thought, wow, performing for these 12 people scares me more than 12,000 at Madison Square Garden. This will be good for me.
Yeah.
Keep me out of trouble. And that led me to writing.
So Robert Bly, as your poetic father figure, you describe him as showing his sword in a speech that he gave denouncing the Vietnam War. How have you shown your sword?
Well, I've tried to keep the integrity of the Doors music, you know. I mean, unfortunately, I had to start a lawsuit against my bandmates to get them to not use the Doors name. You know, the Stones without Mick, the Police without Sting. Come on, Doors without Jim. You could say founding members, former members. This is all water under the bridge. That's completely over with, but I was pleased to persevere.
So in your chapter with Willie Nelson, you're talking about how music is vibrancy and how a good song is a wedding between lyric and melody. But I don't recall you actually giving a specific example then. So what's an example of a really great wedding between lyric and melody?
Well, you know, Jim couldn't play a chord on any instrument. He had all these words, and he said that the only way he could remember them was think of melodies. So now I'm going to prove that I'm not a singer. Before you slip into unconsciousness. That's the song Crystal Ship.
Right.
Really complicated chord changes to fit that. And he just did that off the top of his head. Now, that's brilliant. That's a wedding between lyric and melody that's just, you know. Great.
So Crystal Ship, is that off Waiting for the Sun, maybe?
No, that's on the first album.
It is on the first album?
Yeah.
So Willie also tells this drummer joke about you can tell if the floor is level by looking to see which side of the drummer's mouth the drool's coming out of.
No, I tell that joke.
That's your joke? Okay, all right.
In response to him saying, what's a guitar player without his guitar? Homeless.
So that's your favorite drummer joke, though? The one about the drool?
Well, it's the only joke I know, drummer-wise.
Well, I have a favorite one.
Here we go.
You ready?
Yeah. It's
what do you say to a drummer in a three-piece suit?
But up.
Will the defendant please rise?
Manfred, you better do stand-up.
You're telling me I've got a second career on the way. Well, you know, after this pandemic thing, I think I can make people suffer a different way. So the other surviving member of the Doors is Robbie Krieger. Do you keep in touch with him much these days?
I do a little bit. Well, nobody's in touch with anybody these days. Yeah. But Robbie and I, we've played together several times in the last few years at a benefit for the homeless. And right after the lawsuit, we played at the L.A. County Museum. And it was healing just after a minute. We were back into those songs that are in our blood.
Good. I'm very happy to hear that. Any desire to revive the Butts Band ever?
No.
No.
No, but that got me into reggae. That got me into Jamaica before reggae came to the States. So that was an incredible gift. So, I mean, I knew that was coming.
Well, can you elaborate on that some? Because when I was reading that, so I'm recalling here, it's like not Ray, but the other three guys, you and Jim and Robbie, wound up going to Jamaica, and maybe there's some servant or some helper that's like playing some reggae stuff, or maybe just ska stuff at that point. Can you elaborate on how you came to find out about reggae stuff and then Bob Marley?
Yeah, my phone was ringing. It stopped now. Well, the first time we went to Jamaica was after Miami, after that mess.
Right, right.
We were exposed to reggae, early reggae and ska. But then later, we were in England. The Butts Band was recording, and the bass player, Phil Chin, who played with Rod Stewart and Jeff Beck, he was Chinese Jamaican, born in Jamaica. And he said, oh, can we go to Jamaica to finish this? And I can see my mom. And we did that. And we got exposed to Jimmy Cliff and all this stuff. And then I went back to L.A. and I had Linda Ronstadt's bass player come over. And I said, hey, listen to this stuff. And he said, what, Reggie? I said, no, not reggae, reggae. And a year later, Linda covered Many Rivers to Cross and had a number one hit. So you're welcome.
But you don't claim credit for Clapton and I Shot the Sheriff, though. He kind of, I guess he found that on his own.
Yeah, but the Butts Band did record Get Up, Stand Up.
Right.
And we heard that Marley liked it. And that was about a year before Clapton did I Shot the Sheriff. So we were on the ground floor there.
Are there any seekers that you didn't include in the book that upon reflection, like, oh, you know, I should have added that in. I should have spoken about that.
Well, not offhand, but it is kind of a natural for part two, isn't it?
Yes.
A lot of drummers out there I could talk about.
Well, you know, you mentioned Bob Dylan tangentially a couple of times. I was wondering, do you recognize him as a seeker that, you know, is related to your own life through his art or not?
Sure. I think I write about how Hurricane Carter, who was the subject of Bob's song Hurricane, and you know, helped get him out of jail, you know, kept asking Bob, what are you seeking? What are you searching for all the time? And Bob said, the Holy Grail, meaning you'll never find it, but it's the search. That's right. The important thing. They asked him if he was happy, and he wouldn't answer the question. What I found out is that the giant concerts are great, you know, adulation, but the road there, like we're going to make a living at playing music, that's the real high. And so when you're on the road, you get fed. Reaching the goal is not necessarily the end all be all.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's think this ties into someone. So in the book's conclusion, you write about how everyone needs to get lost into something they love to make room for your own practice. How about yourself? How, like, are you continuing to practice? You practice the drums? I mean, how much time do you spend, like, drumming and working on that aspect of your art, or keeping fresh or up on it? Or
you know, Manfred, actually I don't drum that much lately. I'm really into writing, and I feel like the length of a sentence is kind of musical. It's if it's short, it's percussive, and if it's long, then it's melodic. or it's a run-on sentence and you better edit it. So that's kind of where I've been at as far as my practice.
So that's making me think back to something you said earlier about doing your audiobook version of The Seekers, right? I mean, you've got your writing married to what you've just described. You know, you're creating that percussive element with the short sentences, and you're creating this sort of with longer prose, longer sentences. You're kind of making songs this way, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, when I write, I'll read the paragraph I just wrote out loud, kind of like a vocalist, to see if it flows like a singer.
Oh, very cool. Well, I want us to go out on L.A. Woman. Well, in the book, you mentioned sitting in with artists on various occasions, and at least a couple of times you're playing the Doors song L.A. Woman. One time it's with the L.A. Philharmonic, and once with Willie Nelson's Sons Band. Is L.A. Woman the Doors song people are most apt to cover?
I don't know about that, but L.A. Woman is one of my most favorites. Jim's concept of L.A., a city, as a woman, never saw a woman so alone. I mean, I think that's really pretty brilliant to toot the horn of my singer, but, you know, I just got
in the L.A. area. Right? You grew up.
I just got into town about an hour ago. I took a look around to see which way the wind blows. Oh, the guy was great.
And you're from the Los Angeles area originally.
I was born here. My mom was born here in 1904. But we're not natives. The Chumash Indians were here first.
Right. Man, John, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations, and best of luck with the new book, The Seekers, Meetings with Remarkable Musicians and Other Artists.
Manfred, it was really cool rapping with you.
All right. Right now, here's L.A. Woman from The Doors and Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was The Doors with some of L.A. Woman, wrapping up our Coolest Conversations here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to John Densmore for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast, both parts 1 and 2. And please join me again next week for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.